Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 303 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Amanda Dalton considers the ventriloquism of the author and encounters the deeper writing self that can speak uncomfortable truths from the gut. Then, Sharak Hussain unveils the obstacles faced by the author, however well established, who's contemplating a mid-career change of genre. First, here's Amanda Dalton with The Ventriloquist's Dummy, Writing and the Gut.
Growing up in the 1960s and 70s, I was never very keen on ventriloquism. It was popular on TV, animal dummies that were meant to be cute, and those rather creepy dolls sitting on the knees of some equally creepy and not very funny men. Other than Shari Lewis, I remember them all as men. Disturbing films like Magic and Dead of Night, stories where the dummy takes on a demonic life of its own. They scared me silly, but perhaps what disturbed me most was not the doll, but the bloke with his hand up its bottom. Anthony Hopkins as the unbalanced, increasingly deranged Corky, twice as scary as his foul-mouthed wooden sidekick Fats, who's merely an unsubtle manifestation of Corky's psyche as he descends into madness. The traditional ventriloquist's act involves a dummy that's frequently world-weary, drunk, droll, or childishly amusing, and almost always outspoken, rude to the ventriloquist, somehow in opposition. The ventriloquist apologises to the audience on behalf of their transgressive friend, and if the act is skillful enough, we almost forget that the dummy's not a real, autonomous being. As in some of the best novels, perhaps, when a fictional protagonist can temporarily become more alive to us than the flesh and blood human sitting beside us as we read. I can't say ventriloquism ever really crossed my mind, until I was doing some research around an apparently completed unrelated topic, the gut. I came across the word gastromancy, gaster meaning belly, mantia meaning prophecy, and discovered that ventriloquism, which itself comes from the Greek venter meaning belly and loqui meaning speak, has its origins in ancient Greece, through the work of gastromancers. I learned that the spirits of the dead were thought to live in the gut of the gastromancer and to speak through them. The ghostly voices would gurgle away in the gastromancer's gut before rising up into his throat and out of his mouth, a spew of prophetic words and profound truths. Premier League gastromancers achieved the extra impressive feat of having the dead spirit speak through a nearby tree or rock or even a goat. They had clearly perfected the art not only of speaking without moving their lips, but of throwing the voice. Gastromancy was big business. But then Christianity came along and set about denouncing it as one of the dark arts. It didn't take long for a few hapless belly prophets to be burned as witches and for the serious work of prophecy and divination to morph into a form of entertainment much closer to the ventriloquism we recognise today. But the two are not far removed from one another, are they? The spirit speaking through the belly prophet, and the transgressive dummy arguing with the rational public character of the ventriloquist, saying what the vent could never say, upsetting the apple cart and frequently speaking the truth. The inner voice residing in the gut of the ancient Greek, manifesting in the ventriloquist's dummy. Perhaps because I was thinking about ventriloquism, I started to notice the word popping up all over the place in relation to writing. A novelist praised for her ventriloquial talent, the creative writing course entitled The Writer as Ventriloquist, Mastering Voice and Tone. It's a rather fancy way of stating the obvious, perhaps, that a writer frequently inhabits the voices of others, can appear to become another. Perhaps the ventriloquial writer does so in a particularly clever or startling way, putting words into someone else's mouth, animating the inanimate, speaking in tongues. A writer might be described as a ventriloquist if she's particularly skilled at writing from first-person viewpoints that are very clearly not her own. And yes, there is something about how imagination and memory often work together that, for me anyway, can make writing feel like an act of conjuring ghosts. But I started to think about the writer not as the ventriloquist, but as the dummy. Not as the gastromancer, but as the spirit of the dead. We talk about gut feeling, don't we? Sometimes we choose to go with the gut or follow our gut instinct over logic or reason. And usually when we say this, we imply that we were right. Gut knowledge is powerful and usually authentic. And we know instinctively that our intuition somehow resides in our intestines. A strange idea, perhaps, though not so strange, as any scientific researcher in this field will tell us. The mind-gut connection is a very real thing. And in a way, the gut is our second brain. Gut feelings are not simply the preserve of ancient Greek prophets. So it perhaps makes sense that just as the ventriloquist dummy so often speaks the unpalatable truth, undercutting the ventriloquist's social niceties, so the gut expresses the deeper, sometimes unconscious, truths and knowledge that we might struggle to access through our careful, conforming, conscious minds. The writer is the dummy. The gut is the dummy. I have wayward guts, inflamed, out of control and ridiculously oversensitive. Since long before they made me think of ventriloquist dummies, my guts have reminded me of a very intelligent rescue dog my mum used to have, a watchful, intuitive animal, quick to learn and with a highly developed sixth sense. But he regularly refused to toe the line, and if anyone knocked the front door or brought food into a room, or sometimes for no apparent reason at all, he would go into his nervous breakdown mode, spinning round and round very fast, screaming as he tried to bite his own tail. Usually he succeeded, whereupon he'd stop spinning and try to run away from himself, leaving a little trail of blood along the floor and up the skirting board. My guts are like that dog, highly strung and clever and crazy. I sometimes think they'll be the death of me. I sometimes think they know me better than I know myself. If I'm the respectable ventriloquist smiling at the crowd, my guts are definitely the dummy. And as a writer, I have an unfortunate theory that in order for anything I write to feel true or real or honest, it needs to come from my gut. Oh dear, nobody in their right mind would want to write from my gut. For me, writing from the gut is, well, partly about writing without the censorious editor or ventriloquist getting too much in the way. Not quite the same as stream of consciousness or automatic writing. I think it's more to do with being unafraid to write what might at times feel transgressive or impolite or disorderly. Or using the process of writing to discover who we are. Perhaps it's what E.M. Forster meant when he said, "How do I know what I think until I see what I say?" And it has to do with freeing the voice or allowing the tongue to slip. As the psychoanalyst Lacan once wrote, through slips of the tongue, we discover our own voice. It's something I find difficult to do. It's my form of writer's block, I guess, my inhibition. If I were a ventriloquist, my dummy would frequently stutter or forget its lines or ask me to speak on its behalf. Then at the show's climax, it would spontaneously combust. My friend Andrea is in therapy. She says she likes to have something to do on the train when she's off to see Dr. Cardiff. So-called as it's where he lives. Andrea knows all about my wayward guts, and now I've got her into ventriloquism. On recent journeys to and from Cardiff, she's watched YouTube for hours, and now she says she's bought a book on how to do it yourself, how to speak without moving your lips, Gokhale Gya. For a minute, when she tells me this, I think she's lost the plot. Andrea as a ventriloquist. But then I realise she's kind of joking, and it's a metaphor. Therapy's hard, she says. I wish I could do it without moving my lips. I wish a little puppet thing could sit on my knee and say all the probably awful things that I don't even know are inside me waiting to come out. Her puppet would be a talking guinea pig, she says. Don't ask. And because she would be so skillfully throwing her voice and not moving her lips at all, she wouldn't feel responsible for a word it spoke. Apparently she blurted all this out to Dr. Cardiff, who pointed out that whilst it would be fine for her to say hide behind her hands a bit if she felt embarrassed or ashamed by some of the things she might say to him, he would hope that the process of therapy would not enable her to deny her feelings, but rather to own them and thereby work them through with him. So far, Andrea says, they've reached a kind of compromise with a special code for when she might be trying to talk about something difficult. He'll start by asking her if the guinea pig has anything to say, Or she'll say, the guinea pig asked me to tell you. I think Andrea and Dr. Cardiff have quite possibly both lost the plot, but I'm going to try it myself, on my own, for writing. I'm going to imagine the ventriloquist's dummy, not a guinea pig, but possibly a very intelligent, crazy dog, is writing my next book of poems, or a play. I'm going to let it take the pen from my hand, hear what it has to say. It's Andrea I have to thank for discovering the YouTube films of the ventriloquist Nina Conti with her hand puppet monkey, especially the extraordinary series Nina Conti in Therapy, which kind of enacts all the things I've been thinking about ventriloquism, the gut, and creativity, and therapy. I can't bring myself to call monkey a dummy. Puppet sounds nicer, but in my head, monkey's not that either. Monk, as Nina Conti affectionately calls him, is a foul-mouthed, morose, but spectacularly rude, very cute, very funny, very complete creation. And all the more extraordinary because pretty much all of Nina Conti's routines are improvised. She speaks of Monk as the proper pen in her hand. And he is definitely, for my money, speaking from Nina Conti's gut. He is the slip of her tongue, the freeing of her voice. She said herself, I try not to get in the way of what I think Monkey would say. Monkey is the truer me. I try to give Monkey free rein, but it's dangerous. It means that he's entitled to the first thought that occurs, the one we're conditioned not to say. In an interview in the Independent newspaper, she remembers a recording she'd made of the late, great Ken Campbell, her mentor and one-time lover, telling Monkey about creativity and quoting Schiller. Monkey, he said, there is a gatekeeper in the mind, and it's the gatekeeper that stops you being creative. It's your job, Monkey, to kill off the gatekeeper. She can't do it. You can. Kill off the gatekeeper, so that we can go raw into spontaneous imagination and creation. Yes, Ken. Yes, Monkey. Yes, Andrea and Dr. Cardiff. Let's do it.
That was Amanda Dalton. You can find out more about Amanda on the RLF website. Next, here's Sharuk Hussain with Genre Hopping.
If you've ever tried to change from your established genre, say historical fiction to sci-fi, then you already know that the news is received with great caution. Agents and publishers, the gatekeepers to a writer's dreams, immediately enumerate the pitfalls, warning that there will be radical transformations in the technical aspects of writing. You'll have to overhaul your mindset and reset your voice to communicate effectively with a new demographic. For an agent, it's worse than going back to the beginning, because it's harder to sell a repurposed product than a brand new one. They must feel truly excited about the prospect and its potential, because it's their enthusiasm that will convince the publisher to take the next step and get their market departments buzzing with ideas of how to reach new readers. Timing is important too. As the writer experiments with the new typescript, sometimes producing draft upon draft, honing, refining, even starting again, their loyal fans may tire of waiting and go elsewhere. With the exception usually of chart-busting names, it's rarely worth the effort. So the stakes are high for the rest of us. If our new project doesn't reel in a new audience, the gate could click firmly shut on our existing career. Very occasionally, there's a natural progression. When producers option a book for a movie, the writer could get to try their hand at the screenplay. Or a novelist, famously keen on gardening, for example, might be invited to write a book on the subject. A memoir from an author with a colourful life could prove a popular one-off too. But for the genre swap to be welcome, the author in question needs to offer a certain cachet. That's something special which adds allure to the project. In general, though, genre hopping continues to be regarded a costly risk for all concerned. If the project fails, the writer has the most to lose. The majority of publishers factor in selected loss leaders, books chosen for prestige or some other advantage, and expect the bestsellers on their list to compensate for them. But a mid-list genre hopper who fails could be back on Newbie Street, poring through websites to find new representation. feeling rejected before even getting started. The exclusions flash off the page. No children's fiction, no scripts, no memoirs or autobiographies, no literary fiction, even no commercial fiction. It's disheartening. I remember the sickening fear I felt when my novel didn't appeal to my agent. I admire it, she said, but to get you a good deal, I'd have to be in love with it. I couldn't bring myself to abandon my book. I had nurtured it on high days and holidays, painfully aware that for the first time in 15 years, I was writing without an advance or a contract, because despite a reasonable output, I was a novice again. In a moment of bravado, I chose to stand up for my book. My agent and I parted company. But I was too paralysed to move forward. It was several weeks before I picked up the phone, horribly nervous, and rang my previous agent. Luckily, we were quickly back on track and he placed the novel. But those lost weeks brought a shocking realisation of how much the security blanket of an agent comes to mean. Without one, I felt diminished. Looking back, I've wondered what drove me to hold on to my dream of seeing that novel published, despite nagging doubts. In a good relationship, agent and author are two vital components of a single goal. It may sound melodramatic, but I felt cut in half. Yet, despite some successful genre hopping, the lack of faith in transitioning hovers, as does the conviction to break new ground. Admittedly, a writer of brutal thrillers would change gear significantly to produce a light romance, and a screenwriter planning a novel or vice versa would have to work hard to acquire different techniques. But surely, the story is the main event. And once they find their story, most writers become quickly familiar with the characters and their behaviour and concerns, even their turn of phrase. All this comes naturally, before the writing begins, though many delicious discoveries are still in store. These thought processes are the writer's daily diet. So are their preoccupations with societal issues, human relations, politics, all of which are easily transferable to virtually any genre. Authors undertake new projects with their skill set and their concerns intact and ready to apply in other contexts. There will still be major challenges, tone, level, structural issues, all need to be tackled, some subtly, some more noticeably. But I'm convinced that the knack of story making is hardwired into the human mind, and it starts early. It's there in a toddler's fibs, a child's excuses, the antics of the ubiquitous invisible friend. The creative imagination first manifested in the cave frescoes of our prehistoric ancestors. And in their fireside fantasies, they transformed mammoths into monsters, and the sky and its planets into gods and heroes who powered the epics that have provided universal entertainment for centuries. We have only to compare folk stories down the ages to see how they vary in tone and tension from bright and positive to dark and gruesome. From Charles Perrault with his cautionary retellings to Angela Carter's complex, highly stylized feminist reworkings for adult readers. Within 2 years of writing their scrupulously collected volume of folk tales, the Brothers Grimm famously bowdlerized their own scholarly work and adapted it into the child-friendly Kinder und Hausmärchen. The stories of the swapped version still flourish and grow, finding ever new and hugely popular incarnations in books, as well as visual formats like graphic novels, TV and cinema. But these are classics, so the gatekeepers remain reluctant, authors stick to their guns, and the relationship comes under threat. The essential conflict of priorities is best clarified by Betsy Lerner. In her book, The Forest for the Trees, an Editor's Advice to Writers, Lerner points out, the making of art and the selling of it are two entirely separate enterprises, starkly contrasting the essential interests of the agent and publisher on the business side with those of the writer, the creative partner. The agent kicks off the process, with the publisher as the sharp end, scooping up the bulk of the enterprise from financial investment to grooming and branding the author's manuscript, and getting it into bookshops. The publishing process looks glamorous from the outside, but it's grueling hard work. Half a dozen different departments and services and numerous individuals are involved in each book. It is time-consuming and expensive, and much thought and love goes into it. Editors perfect the text, salespeople get it on the shelves, and if they can demonstrate the appeal of the book, on the fast table. Promotional teams convince broadcasters, reviewers, bloggers and festival organisers that the book is a must-read. Practically, grooming authors and getting them known to booksellers, reviewers and readers is not worth the investment, only to have them chance it all on a whim. In fact, most publishers make sure before they sign them up that new writers have other projects already in line. And so the dilemma rages. Without the investor, the business wouldn't take off, but without the product, the investor would have nothing to sell. For the writer, though, it's a lot murkier. Creativity is not as concrete as business models. Agents and publishers have a glut of manuscripts to choose from, whereas lone authors may soon feel disheartened and metaphorically foot-weary, tramping around in a vast and uncompromising publishing landscape because they've tried to change course. In an industry bulging with writers, the hard slog of the selling falls to the gatekeepers, while authors work away at their art in solitude, frequently racked with self-doubt about their decision. If they fail, they face the consequences alone. If they provide a satisfactory work, though, they're flipped into the selling side and embark on signing and speaking tours, interviews, festivals, and the whole circus of promotion. And in our digital era, there's the additional virtual marketplace of blog tours, interviews on Skype or Zoom, Facebook, YouTube, and other interactive media. Celebrity at last. Or so it seems for a short, surreal period. In spite of all that effort, the enterprise could still fail, leaving the parties in a painful position, parting ways with nurturers and partners. And that, as I've already said, is frankly terrifying. So, what is it that fuels the compulsion to sacrifice or compromise the relationship with agent and publisher, and in the process lose that utterly precious loyal readership? Authors, like readers, can have eclectic interests. When an ideal appeals, the imagination whirs into action, replacing thoughts of target demographics and genre constraints with endorphin-induced convictions of smashing through restrictive barriers to the winning post. All the while, underneath the excitement, the trepidation of tackling a new undertaking rarely vanishes entirely. But passion conjures up an irresistible vision of fabulous outcomes. As the enterprise progresses, writers' euphoria diminishes, and when the manuscript is sent out, self-doubt intensifies 100-fold. And yet, a rejection, if it comes, is crushing. It's almost impossible to define what lies behind the desperate urge to extend our creative selves. I loved my myth-writing days. Every moment was a joy, conceiving the idea, researching, writing, developing characters. I never stopped being amazed that I was actually paid for the privilege. During that time, several ideas for other genres, mainly novels, were born and died. Others still languish in old files. But one kept resurfacing like a phoenix picking at my elbow, demanding to be reborn. And that was the one that drove me. I've never regretted it. I needed to extend my range and fulfil the dream of my childhood, to write a novel. Some writers tell me they turbocharge their income by changing genre. Others simply don't want to be trapped by labels. Maybe they're just bursting like I was to write about an idea that has gripped them by the throat. And when that inspiration strikes, it clings like an enchantment that can only ever be lifted when the task is fulfilled. Can writers find a way to capture and communicate that witchery and minimise the risk of losing established readers? A family dynamic, maybe, that can be found as easily in Harry Potter as in a harrowing memoir like A Boy Called It? Possibly. if the marketing strategy flags up to established readers that they will continue to find elements in the new work that they loved in previous books. Such a specifically fine-tuned marketing strategy and its accompanying expense may well lie behind the secret of the genre-hopping success of some big-name writers who glide easily between categories. Is it madness, then, for the rest of us writers to believe we can tap into a universal sensibility or experience that transcends categories and simply delivers a good book? Genre hopping may look like a crazy risk, yet some writers have flourished as a result. And who knows, a touch of madness may be exactly what's needed to embolden us to abandon caution and follow our bliss.
That was Sharak Hussain. You can find out more about Sharak on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 303, which was recorded by Amanda Whittington and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 304, Sue Teddern speaks with Bethan Roberts about the many facets of her career and the constraints of commercial writing. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.